layer security, cybersecurity kill chain, and the MITRE ATT&CK framework. But that's all the time we've got for today. I'll have to go into those other topics on another show.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Valkovsky, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. Today we have a returning guest who is making another appearance on Education Matters. Dr. Andrew Saltz is an associate professor of educational policy and the director of the Education and Leadership PhD program at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. Welcome back, Dr. Saltz.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Dr. Saltz studies educational accountability, federal education policy, and the intersection between health and education policy. He started his career as a high school social studies teacher and served on his local school board in Michigan during the Great Recession. Dr. Saltz earned a BA in political science from Oregon State University, an MAT in social studies from Lewis and Clark, and a PhD in educational policy from Michigan State University. And he, last time we talked to him, he was teaching at Miami University in Ohio. He now lives in Portland, Oregon, in the neighborhood he grew up in, with his wife and two sons, and enjoys reading and exploring the outdoors. That's so cool that you're in the neighborhood you grew up in.
Yeah, it's an absolute dream. I think it speaks to how much I enjoyed my childhood to want to raise my kids here.
Oh, that is great. So I do want to point out that Dr. Saltz spent 12 years in the Midwest, though, so he is very familiar with our context. But our questions for him are really about federal education policy. And it's important to kind of figure this out, because even though most of our decisions for education are made at the district and the state level, the federal government does play a role. So last time when he visited us in 2017, he gave an overview of federal education policy and made some predictions on the likely changes to federal policy under President Trump. Today, he'll be updating us on what happened with federal policy during the past 4 years and look ahead to the next four. So as we did when you last visited us, I'd just like you to give a bit of an overview on the role the federal government plays in education in the United States. What do the feds do? For how long have they been involved, and why? Because one thing I think most people maybe don't know is education is not in the Constitution as one of the duties of the federal government. So
yeah,
you can enlighten us.
Well, thank you again for having me. And I think that's a good place to start, that since education is not explicitly listed as a power for the federal government, states have the authority to control their education system. So the federal government over time has really gotten involved to solve maybe bigger issues in education. And I like to start with the Lyndon Johnson administration in the 1960s as part of the war on poverty. There was a recognition that students living in poverty were not given the same opportunities as other students. And so the Elementary and Secondary Education Act was passed in 1965 as part of the Great Society programs that Johnson had imagined, and it was really poverty focused. What can we do at the federal level to provide additional funding for students living in poverty? So, a lot of times when people think about schools, they can think about curriculum or teachers or things like that. And the federal government was at a little bit higher level of aggregation there. In the 70s, that evolved to really addressing students with disabilities. And again, a population where states and local governments had not done enough to serve those students. More recently, my students know about No Child Left Behind, and that was President Bush's attempt in 2001 to bring more accountability. How do we evaluate schools? And really rested on the notion we should be testing students in math and reading and publishing those test results and evaluating schools on those test results. My studies really started with President Obama, and President Obama really embedded some of the ed policy reforms around efforts to improve the economy during the Great Recession. And so it was kind of fascinating. You know, you mentioned I was in the Midwest for about 12 years. Part of that time I was on a school board in mid-Michigan. And I remember a school board meeting, the superintendent says, hey, do you folks want to agree to apply to Race to the Top? Because Michigan wants to apply to kind of this incentive program that the Obama administration had put forward. Well, we were looking at like a 10% budget crunch at the time. And so, you know, a lot of my colleagues were like, well, of course, if this is extra money, we'll do kind of anything. And I think it speaks to kind of some of the negotiation that goes on across across the federal, state, and local governments. And so I became really interested in that. And perhaps that's a good way of thinking about both the Obama administration, then I know we're going to talk about the Biden administration, but with these crises that happened, the Great Recession during Obama, and then certainly COVID and COVID economic recovery, I think it's provided an opportunity for the federal government to try and shift education policy through additional funding. President Trump really wanted to reduce the role of the federal government, and so much of the effort there was to shift from kind of general funding to states to more specific tax credits or funds directly to families. Secretary of Education DeVos was very interested in things like vouchers or private choice. And Biden seems to want to use some of the economic recovery plan, the Rescue Act, as we'll talk about, to invest in different portions of the educational system, much in the way Obama did during the Great Recession. So that's a really broad overview with a lot of things in there, but I know we'll get more into depth as we go along.
Okay, great. Thank you for that overview. Last time we spoke, you told us that the federal government spends only 6% of the discretionary budget, which is only 29% of the federal budget overall. So what does that come out to, like less than 1% of the total federal budget? Did that change at all under President Trump? Has it increased or decreased in amount, or is it just focused differently?
Yeah, well, and one of the things about the federal government, as you know, is the tension between the executive and legislative branches. So Trump's budget request was about a 10% reduction below the 2019 appropriation. The Senate and the House actually proposed increases, and they kind of settled on about a 2% increase from 2019 to 2020 budget. Spending for education, you can't really just focus on that, though, because as we previously mentioned, part of the economic recovery plan under Biden has been a lot of COVID relief packages that include education funding. So both the Trump and Biden administrations have embedded some of that, which goes to states in particular, and they can use that to backfill some school budgets. So overall, I would say spending is about what it was when we talked 4 years ago, with slight increases per year, outside of the larger kind of economic packages.
Okay, and then what were some of the policies that President Trump proposed, and you know, how many of those you know, still exist? We'll get to what Biden is planning to do later, but what did he propose, and how many of them actually went through?
Yeah, so the two big shifts that Trump wanted in federal education policy was, one, a focus on individuals and families and school choice, and two, a movement away from some of the protections under the Office of Civil Rights that the Obama administration had established. So in that first section, Trump really believed in a lot of tax credits and opportunities for families to use public dollars or tax dollars to go to private schools or to homeschool. DeVos was very outspoken about supporting online charters and school voucher programs. That didn't see legislative movement in Congress, but what it did was a lot of states, a lot of red states, then picked up some of those similar initiatives and passed them at the state level. The second big thing the Trump administration did under Secretary DeVos was, you know, the Obama administration was really focused on school integration, particularly racial integration, and Trump really moved away from any sort of race conscious policy. And so there's a whole bunch of kind of nuanced executive actions within education policy around integration. There's something called the disparate impact rule, which basically says it doesn't matter what your intentions are. If you're treating different classes of students or individuals differently, then you can be held accountable there. The Trump administration delayed the implementation of the disparate impact rule affecting special education in particular. So whereas the Obama administration was really trying to use some of the civil rights and equal protection clauses to protect classes of students, the Trump administration was really trying to delay some of that action through executive action.
Okay. One of the things you mentioned was online charters. So a lot of us have experience with online teaching and learning now. So I'm wondering, did the charters do well? Do you think they'll continue to do well? Or are we all now so tired of online learning that that'll never happen again?
Yeah, well, it depends on what you say, what you mean by doing well. One way to evaluate success is on enrollment. And enrollment in virtual charter schools saw huge surges, as we might imagine, because in a lot of states, they decided not to have in-person instruction. Mm-hmm. And so you saw, you know, huge surges. K-12 Inc., one of the biggest online charters, said they had a 57% enrollment increase, taking up to 195,000 students. Connections Academy, which is another larger online charter school, saw a 41% jump. And so I do think in these states in particular that had kind of the tradition of online charters, a lot of families were attracted to those during the pandemic, as a lot of local districts kind of never had experienced online schooling before. And so they had to scramble to figure out platforms, to figure out, you know, how to talk to teachers about that and whatnot. And so you did see a growth in enrollment. I want to separate growth in enrollment from necessarily success, because the literature, and there's been a lot of research on online charters in the state of Ohio and Pennsylvania in particular, and that research has pretty much shown across the board that online charters, students in online charters are not learning to the same degree as traditional public schools. As measured by test scores. But if you look at the test scores of students that do online education, historically, there has not been a lot of evidence that students are learning as much online as they do in person.
Yeah, that rings sort of true. I'm sure listeners, you know, who have kids in online school this year or have been teaching online probably would agree. I just had a big meeting with a group of our noise scholars from that are science teachers in the local schools and their mentor teachers last night online, and they all sort of were shaking their head over both trying to teach hybrid, but also just, you know, what the learning losses are going to be and how they'll make them up next year, particularly for kids who were in eighth grade this year or ninth grade this year, because ninth grade is such a crucial year in high school. And you know, if you were tuned out of your online learning platform, you know, it's going to be rough for next year. It's going to be like having two classes of freshmen, I think.
So. Yeah. And I mean, what I encourage people to do is to not compare kind of the last year to a traditional year.
Right.
I consider it being learning during pandemic. And, mm-hmm. you know, I know families and students and teachers were doing the best they could, but there should also be a recognition that people were dealing not just with new learning platforms, but a lot of trauma. So I'm encouraged. I know we'll get to the Biden administration here in a second about some of the efforts to kind of recognize that and hopefully help students and families through the transition back to normal.
Okay, so just kind of dialing back again to 2017, when we spoke then, we were talking about legislative initiatives. So, we're dividing the federal government is the executive branch and the orders and what the Secretary of Education can do. And then also the Congress can pass laws and or approve or not approve of particular budget items. So at the time, there was a legislative initiative called HB 10, which was being introduced by Representative Steve King of Iowa, who is no longer in the Congress, I believe, right? Vouchers for homeschool and private school, eliminating nutrition guidelines that had been established under the Obama administration and abolishing ESEA entirely and making it all block grants to the state. So did any of this pass? Have there been any results of it?
So through Congress, no, by and large, it hasn't passed. And one of the stories, I think, of Congress of the past even decade, going back to the Obama administration, is really Congress has a hard time agreeing on much. And so we've seen more and more executive actions to create policy. And I think Obama was criticized for that. A lot of executive actions, waivers in education and health policy. And then Trump kind of picked that up. And so Secretary DeVos, for example, used $180 million in federal COVID relief funds earmarked to create voucher-like grants for parents and to expand virtual education, which was much in line with what I think Representative King was trying to do with HB 10. ESEA exists still, so it was not eliminated, but I think that bill demonstrates a conservative idea or philosophy that the federal government should have no or very little role in education policy. And so I think Secretary DeVos did some of that through that COVID relief bill, but by and large, no, they did not eliminate the ESEA.
Okay. So let me just reintroduce. You're listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of federal education policy with expert Dr. Andrew Saltz of Pacific University is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. And once this is up on the Facebook page, I will link to the archive of your 2017 interview as well, so people can compare if they would like to. So let's move on. We kind of segued back and forth between 2017 and today, but here we are in 2021. We have a new president and a different makeup of Congress. So first of all, what do you think of President Biden's choice for Education Secretary Miguel Cardona?
Well, I think I'm excited about Secretary Cardona. It's rare that political appointees don't have, you know, huge controversies involved, but the approval process for Secretary Cardona went about as well as it can in these political times. Secretary Cardona started his career as an elementary school teacher, served as a principal and an assistant superintendent, and then really gained national notoriety as the Commissioner of Education in Connecticut. And there were a couple of things that he was kind of noted for as commissioner. One was expanding data systems, really expanding high school students' ability to fill out the FAFSA and making that easier, really addressing special education and a kind of strong commitment to English language learners as well. And so I think Secretary Cardona was a choice that was meant to really highlight someone with deep education experience, perhaps in contrast to Secretary DeVos, who was involved in education policy at a very different level, mostly philanthropically rather than kind of on the ground as a administrator and teacher. So I think it will be interesting to see how the Department of Education evolves, but it's a pretty stark contrast, in my opinion, between Betsy DeVos and Miguel Cardona.
Yeah, I have to say that Cardona also, was not on my radar, but when I read his credentials, I was like, oh, wow, they actually have an educator, somebody who has a lot of experience working with children and as an administrator. Because really, other than Rod Paige, have we had one of those in the last 20 years?
I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about, right, that a lot of individuals are selected who are on what I would consider the periphery of the daily work of schooling. And so if you recall back to the election, actually, in the Democratic primary, President Biden, then candidate Biden, made this commitment to choose someone with teaching experience. And to your point, that doesn't seem like it should be that out of the ordinary, but here we are talking and thinking about the various selections of Secretary of Education. And Cardona does stand out for having a lot more kind of direct experience in schools than other secretaries of education.
Right. I wonder if Dr. Biden, the president's wife, had anything to do with that influence, because it really was like, I actually ran a poll of people I knew, just, you know, like emailed a bunch of people I knew and said, who back in 2008, who do you think Obama's going to choose for education secretary? And I still have that slideshow somewhere of all the potential choices, because I made a presentation about it. And you know, we all thought Arne Duncan could be on the list, but no one was like, oh yes, Arne Duncan, the best possible choice. No one felt that way, because he really had, you know, he was peripheral really to the education process again. So I have to say, this is a breath of fresh air. You know, and Dr. Page, who was one of Bush's secretaries of education, you know, he had his triumphs and his problems too, but I think he had more cred for the fact that he had been a teacher and an administrator.
Yeah, and I think for those of us who have been classroom teachers, there is something about that. I think, you know, it is a very unique experience to go to a K-12 classroom every single day. And I started my career as a social studies teacher,
as you mentioned
prior. Yeah. And so I think, for teachers who have had a very chaotic year, a lot of the feedback I received regarding this nomination and appointment was a lot of relief that someone who had this direct experience and could relate to them in maybe a different and more personal way.
Yeah, so let's find out what it is that that President Biden has planned. So just backing up again, under Obama, the federal government leveraged the stimulus passed to ward off the Great Recession to change aspects of federal policy in education. So has anything similar happened under Biden with the American Rescue Plan for recovery from COVID?
Yes. And I'm glad you drew that parallel, because as I'm studying this, and I was a doc student for much of Obama's administration, and so I do see these parallels. So part of the American Rescue Plan was to give money to states, many of which have then allocated some of that funding to schools. In Oregon, they have announced that they're going to have this huge summer program for public education where students are going to be eligible to come. I think one of the challenges there is who's going to teach. And, you know, a lot of teachers are pretty burnt out right now. But so some of that funding is earmarked for that. Some of the funding also has been earmarked. You know, there have been a lot of increased cost around ventilation. We have not done a very good job with our infrastructure. You know, I know schools throughout the Midwest, for example, many of them are really old and kind of dilapidated. Well, when you think about like COVID safety protocols, part of the ventilation is actually really important for keeping people safe. And so I think the summer learning stuff has been a part of that. I think there is a part of that that states are now earmarking for upgrades in HVAC systems or other ventilation systems. And then, you know, also states are dealing with budget shortfalls. And so while education is not a high percentage of the federal budget, a lot of states use a lot of their budget in K-12 education. So if they see any reduction in funding, those cuts could be felt there. And so I think part of this money will be used to offset some of those budget cuts as well.
Okay. And then is there any other thing that you see coming out of that legislation which already passed, or is there anything coming up that you think is going to be kind of a big deal for K-12 schools?
So for K-12, the USDA, and again, I mean, I think one of the things I want listeners to really get out of this is the executive branch is maybe more active than the legislative branch at the federal level. And so the USDA has continued a meals program. Now, the USDA has had free and reduced price lunch for quite some time, but last year there was a recognition that it might be easier to expand that and expand eligibility. And so they've actually continued that for the 21-22 school year, where all students, if states opt in, all students could be eligible for a free lunch in public schools. So I think that's one important part. Another, I think, is really trying to evaluate the degree to which schools will be part of this infrastructure stuff that Biden is talking about. As we mentioned, a lot of the buildings are older, and the deferred maintenance stuff, particularly in large urban districts, has the price tag on some of that has become pretty extraordinary. So there has been some discussion about how to include that within the infrastructure plans moving forward.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the things about that is, you know, those are public goods, really, those school buildings, and you can keep them up or you can let them fall apart and then replace them at incredible expense later. You know, to the extent they can be retrofitted, it's probably always cheaper to do that. But if, unless they're too far gone and you can't like redo the HVAC system or whatever, I suppose. But yeah, plus it'll put a lot of people to work.
Absolutely.
Network. So that's part of it, I suppose. So as I asked you last time, what do you think really the goal is here? What is the end game for Biden, Cardona, or the Democratic legislators? You know, what's their overall agenda for education for the federal level Democrats?
Yeah, and I'm glad you're posting the 2017. It'd be interesting to go back and see how accurate I was in terms of my prediction for the Trump administration. So the way I view what the end game is for the administration is kind of threefold. I think the first thing, and you saw this actually in week one of the Biden administration, was they want to undo what President Trump and Betsy DeVos did. And so particularly around civil rights, you know, I mentioned the disparate impact of special education. That was in the first week of the Biden administration. They said, we're going to undo this delay in implementation. We want this implemented now. There's some Title IX investigation stuff, particularly for college campus, for folks, sexual assault victims and victims' rights, that those policies were changed under Trump. And so, again, Biden just has almost a 180 view on what should be done there. And so I think they're going to revert to Title IX pre-Trump in that regard. And similarly, the Biden administration is critical of vouchers. So step one for the Biden administration is undo what Trump and DeVos tried to do. I think step two is they want to address how COVID impacted students. And we've talked about learning loss, a recognition that online learning has been really challenging. We have not talked about the mental health component. And so I think there is a shift nationally to address socio-emotional well-being of students. So it's not just kind of how they're learning, but how they're taking care of themselves, how we're making sure their well-being is taken care of. And so there is a movement there beyond just the learning loss from COVID. So COVID very broadly. And then the third thing I would say in terms of their agenda is, you know, Biden is, you know, talking about, and certainly some senators, some Democratic senators as well, like Elizabeth Warren, are talking about, you know, big progressive ideas. You know, they're talking about preschool for all, potentially, for 3 and 4 year olds. They're talking about addressing childhood poverty by giving direct payments to individuals with preschoolers. And they're talking about free community college. And so I think step one, undoing Trump DeVos agenda, step two, addressing that COVID effect. And then step three, what are, you know, big ideas that they could tackle? I'm not convinced they'll get all of that done, but I think there is some movement there. I know the checks, for example, for parents with students that are five or under, or kids that are five or under, are going out this summer, for example. So those are kind of the three buckets that I see them really trying to do moving forward.
Okay. Once again, you are listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of federal education policy with expert Dr. Andrew Saltz of Pacific University is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So we were mostly talking about K through 12, but I feel like there's a big elephant in this discussion on, around federal policy, because this has been tossed around for a few years. The idea of forgiving some portion of student loans or wiping out student loans altogether, or maybe there are some alternatives to that even. I have a few ideas and I haven't really heard that talked about. So do you think this is likely to happen? And if so, what would be the mechanism to do so?
So I think there will be something regarding student loans. I do not think they will wipe out all student loans altogether. So I want to tackle both kind of the what of student loans and then the how, because I think they're really related. If you listen to Senator Warren, there is an effort by some Senate, Dems, as well as some Senate House members in the Democratic Party, that want to set $50,000 as an amount that they would eliminate from student loans. There's also a recognition, we have this public loan forgiveness. If you do 10 years in public service, you can have some of your loans forgiven or all of your loans forgiven. But it looks, I mean, the analysis I've seen have shown that not everyone has been able to take advantage of that, that program is a little bit glitchy. So I think there is an effort to shore that up. What Biden has said publicly is he favors 10,000 instead of 50,000. But part of the reason why is whether or not they actually have to pass this through Congress, which would be very difficult, or have an executive action. So again, I mentioned Obama and Trump. There's been this movement towards the executive branch creating policy. And so Biden in the town hall has said he thinks he could, you know, forgive up to $10,000 in executive action, but $50,000 is too big of a price tag. And so, you know, I'm continually fascinated by this interplay between Congress and the executive branch. I do want to note, you know, the American Rescue Plan that was passed in March had a provision about this in it. And the provision said that loan forgiveness would be taxed free through 2025. So as a precursor to forgiving loans, they had to say you won't be taxed for this as income, because they didn't want to have people have huge tax bills. That kind of defeats the purpose if they had their loans forgiven. And so step one is now loan forgiveness is tax free for the next 4 years. And now step two is they're going to decide how much and who qualifies for that. Mm-hmm. You asked my prediction. I think they will pass something. I don't think they'll get to 50,000. I think they will get to some amount, and I don't know if there will be income or constraints about kind of what industry you're in or not. Mm-hmm. I think they still have quite a bit of negotiating to do around that.
Right. And there is some of this loan forgiveness that already exists and has for quite some time. And there was a little bit of controversy under Secretary DeVos about whether people were being reimbursed. But there is an option for people who work, for example, in my field, which is education. There's something called the Teach Grant, where if you work for a long period of time, 5 years, I believe, is the beginning threshold. You can get some of your loans forgiven for working in a high needs public school. So that's maybe part of this. But what they're proposing is nothing like that. It's not really about where you work. It's more about just saying what your loans are, how much they are, something like that.
Yeah, well, and we're seeing, I mean, I do want to say, for individuals who have graduated college in the last 20, 25 years, the amount of debt is almost like a first mortgage. Mm-hmm. We both work in higher education, so you know, costs have gone up. Part of that has been the public has not invested in higher education, but the cost, I mean, it is very prohibitive, and that is affecting people for the rest of their adult lives in ways that we have not seen in previous generations.
Right. And I will just say that I personally did not finish paying off my loans till I was 46 years old. So it's not just, I didn't even have loans from my PhD. It was all undergrad loans that got carried over. So it's not just people that are right out of college. It takes a while for a lot of people. I think, you know, one of the things that I've often thought about is that really, if the federal government wanted to do something really basic, it would be to just have no interest student loans. Just say, we're not going to charge interest here's some money, borrow it, pay it back when you can. Because that seems to be the thing, the compounding interest on some students who have like high cost loans, like medical school or law school or things like that, are really, or just a very expensive undergraduate institution. That's the thing that's killing them. Is there any idea that that might happen?
Again, I've heard a lot of different circulating ideas. I think the federal rate right now is 6.8 for a lot of the loans. I think there's a famous Einstein quote about the power of compound interest being one of the most powerful forces in the world or something like that. And to your point, yes, we charge 6.8% or even more than that for private loans, student loans. And yet savings accounts are, less than 1% in the country. Right. And so there's this huge disconnect, but yes, there could be movement on the interest rate side as well. Again, I think they will forgive a certain amount and then the degree to which they address this moving forward. And one of the things conservatives say, and I think rightly so, is, the price of higher education is kind of exorbitant and there's no control on it. So if we just forgive loans without doing anything else, we're not really solving the problem. We're addressing a need now without kind of the systemic issue. So I personally would like to see either, whether it's interest rates or, some sort of public investment in higher education to address the rising cost, because mm-hmm. that's why so many people have loans in the first place.
Yeah, I was looking at this a few years ago. UW-Madison in the early 1980s cost less than $1,000 per semester. And now it's per semester, it's well over $6,000 or $8,000. So it's not, I think people look at the sticker price at private colleges like Carthage, and probably is Pacific private as well.
Yeah, Pacific private.
We actually just did a big price cut because most people don't pay the sticker price. So our tuition at Carthage is very comparable to other state universities, both in Illinois and in Wisconsin. Sometimes it's less. So it's much less than U of I, for example. And we get a lot of students from Illinois. So it's interesting to me. I do think that some work needs to be done on that end, but sort of the defunding of state level higher education has been a huge boost, I think, to institutions like yours and mine. And I would personally be really happy to see the state institutions thriving and being affordable for more students.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and one thing we haven't talked about in terms of a higher ed policy from the Biden administration is free community college.
Right.
Right. So one philosophical approach to this is provide free community college, really try to increase enrollments there, and then individuals can transfer in, maybe for their third or fourth year of college, something like that. So that is trying to kind of get at the cost issue and maybe some of the systemic stuff that we're talking about. So I do want to recognize that is kind of a larger system policy shift that has been proposed or at least talked about.
Right. And I, it's an interesting challenge because we have articulation agreements with several community colleges in Northern Illinois and locally. And it's great. They come in and they have a couple of years done, but the issue is that there are too many things that don't transfer directly. So if they don't know where they're going to transfer to, it's not a direct year to year thing. And I always feel terrible for them because I'd love to be able to say, sure, you only have 2 years left, but the reality is that they don't usually. So, but it still ends up being a big savings, I think, for most people.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there certainly are challenges there, but, just to think about both the loan side of things, and then if they go to free community college or whatnot, I think that's where the federal government, the Biden administration, is really putting some of their time into trying to figure that out.
So, and since you and I both began our careers as social studies teachers, I thought it would be interesting to talk about that for our last couple of minutes of this interview. So the past few years have laid bare some of the deficiencies in science and social science and history education. Do you know of any specific efforts to improve those areas at the federal level? I know that President Trump issued a document called the 1776 Report during his final days in office. Tell me anything that you know about this topic and any ideas you have for how we could improve social studies or history education.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, No Child Left Behind put this focus on math and reading. And as a result, some schools, particularly at the elementary school level, kind of hyper-focused on those things, right? If you're going to test these things, we're going to spend all our time on those things. As a result, science and social studies fell off, and there were declines even in things like PE and recess in some communities. And so I think, particularly given the light of what's happened over the last year in our country, there is a recognition that, you know, it might be good to focus on civics again and really try to make sure that people understand their rights, people understand the importance of things like voting. So Biden, in the first week of office, did away with the 1776 commission. And there is an effort by a number of folks in Congress to really have this discussion about how we can better teach civics. And so there is the Civics Secures Democracy Act, which Senators Coons from Delaware, Cornyn from Texas, and a whole host of representatives on both sides of the aisle actually have come together and said, hey, we need to refocus here on civics education in America. And we're actually gonna have federal investments to support and expand access to civics and history education. So I'm pretty encouraged by that. I mean, to be honest with you, anytime I see kind of a bipartisan effort these days, I'm heartened. Maybe it's the idealist in me, but you know, I hope we can all come together. There's a lot of really good research out there that shows that if you have quality civics education, those students then are more likely to vote. They're more likely to talk about politics at home, complete college, develop skills that lead to employment. So, you know, civics education has a lot of positive returns. Actually, students with quote unquote quality civics education are also four times more likely to volunteer in their communities and to communicate with their elected representatives. So I, you know, again, we're both former social studies teachers, but I would argue, and I think there's a lot of evidence that you get a lot of positive returns if you do that. So I'm encouraged by this. I think the bill has not passed yet, but there is this effort by Republicans and Democrats in both the Senate and the House to make something happen, and I'm confident that they will.
Well, just for some reason, and I can't wait to find out when I have them in class next fall, we've had this explosion of people who want to be history and social studies teachers. We doubled our numbers in 1 year, which, you know, have gone from 7 to, I believe there are 14 in this upcoming group. And I can't wait to find out what's inspiring them, because I don't know if it's the atmosphere in which they attended high school, or if their teachers have encouraged them, or what it is, but it's very encouraging to me. So I'm pretty excited about that. We are actually out of time. So I wanted to ask you about what you think role parents, grandparents, and other people listening could play. You answered that question 4 years ago, so people can go back and listen to the end of the old one. But mostly I think you just said, you know, get involved in your local schools. Is that about right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting. So this afternoon, I actually have a kindergarten orientation with my oldest son.
Aww.
And so as I think about what you should do to get involved in schools, you know, I think educating the next generation is all of our responsibility. And so I really encourage you to have conversations at the community level about what you value. I think too oftentimes ed policy narrows the scope around reading and math and other kind of knowledge-based things, which as a parent are important to me, but I also want to make sure that kids are safe and want to make sure that all kids, regardless of their background, are valued and celebrated. And so I would encourage you to work with educators to hear what's going on in your school and to support them in any way that you can.
Great. Thank you so much. Dr. Andrew Saltz, federal education policy expert from Pacific University, thank you for joining us. If you want to listen again, you can find this interview at WGTD.org. Thank you very much. Farewell.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, wgtd.org. You're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit.